You can't delegate digital transformation for your company. You and your executives have to own it. Executives need to engage, embrace, and adopt new ways of working with the latest in emerging technologies. And that's where we come in. Welcome to Embracing Change. The business world is changing at a faster pace than it ever has, and companies need to keep up. We interview the most interesting CEOs, CMOs, and other executives to talk about their challenges with digital transformation in their industry. This is Embracing Change, and this is your host, Gerardo Carrick.
Hey friends, welcome to Embracing Change. This episode is near and dear to my heart because I will be talking with the legendary Henry Martinez, one of the architects of the pay TV industry in Latin America. As an industry, it's an industry that I know really well because I spent 15 years building it as well. And we will touch everything from the beginning of the industry up to now that we talk about the creator economy. I find this episode very interesting because, as you will hear during our discussion, we talked in detail about the many times the entertainment industry had to embrace change and reinvent itself. I really hope you enjoy it. Hi, everyone. Welcome. Welcome to Season 2, Episode 2 of Embracing Change, a live interview-style podcast that focuses on stories of digital transformations presented from the perspective of the people living through them. Our guest today is Henry Martinez. Henry is chairman of the Latin American Media Advertising Council, LAMAC, a nonprofit advocacy group whose mission is to provide national and international advertisers and their agencies with the most up-to-date, comprehensive, and actionable business intelligence on the growing world of multimedia platforms. Prior to this role, Martinez served as president and managing director of Discovery Latin America, US, Hispanic, and Canada. He was responsible for the company's business and operational units for Discovery's 13 real-world entertainment networks in Latin America, as well as two U.S. Hispanic networks. He oversaw Discovery Communications business in Canada and was a board member of Discovery's joint venture with Bell Media in Canada. Henry, on top of that, he is an awesome, awesome guy. He's a native of Florida. So he has this thing about him. Is it Cuban background, Henry? I mean you're a bigger than life personality. Where does that come from? Is that your Cuban background?
I have no idea why you give me that type of title, but okay, thank you.
Welcome, Henry, to our podcast. Where are you connecting from?
Home base, Miami.
Home base in Miami. Excellent, excellent. Thank you so much, Henry. And tell us a little bit about. I've read your bio, but just for the benefit of our listeners, tell us a little bit about your background in the media and entertainment industry, and kind of like you've seen everything in media and entertainment, right?
Well, you're aging me now, but yeah, in a way, I have. I mean, after doing comm school out in California. I joined first an ad agency, one of the initial ad agencies focused on the U.S. Hispanic market. It also had Latin American operations as well, but it was one of the first ones to really put a hyper-focus on U.S. Hispanic. It was known as Siboney Advertising at that point, eventually bought out by one of the large groups. Subsequently, I actually got into cable TV, which basically working for a cable operator in the local South Florida area. Did that for about 11 years of my life and joined Discovery Communications. That was the gold rush of our U.S.-based media companies looking to Latin America and launching in Latin America. So there were several ESPN, HBO, Viacom, Discovery. They were all focused on getting launched in Latin America. And so great opportunity came up, and I joined Discovery, whom I worked with for almost 25 years of my career. Wonderful time and great experiences throughout that journey.
Yeah. So why don't we jump in straight into into the topic of this conversation, right? I mean, we are, you know, the name of the podcast is Embracing Change. And I can't think of many industries that could describe, that could use embracing change better than media and entertainment. I mean, in the last 20, 30 years, media and entertainment has gone through amazing change. You know, let alone, you know, we're gonna get to talking about streaming lately, but there's been digital transformation continuously in media and entertainment for the last 30 years, right?
Oh, I completely agree with that. I mean, I think it goes back to, you know, even the mid-90s, let's say, or the latter portion of the 90s. If you think about it, the whole dot-com bubble, I think that was, you know, the great process, or the great launch pad, if you will, for this process of the digital transformation beginning. I mean, not that we really recognized it, I think, at that point, but it was the process of where this digital transformation was really beginning to take place. It was amazing. I mean, if you think back, it was 1997 when Netflix first launched in whatever way, shape, or form. It was 10 years later when Amazon first launched Amazon Prime Video. Yeah. In its form and fashion at that point in time, you know. But yeah, if you look at the whole dot-com, I would call it dot-com gold rush of the mid to late 90s, and then of course the dot-com bubble bursts, and you know, the markets like the NASDAQ dropped down. You know, they had climbed ridiculously up to over 5,000 points, and then it dropped down to, like, you know, 2,200 or something like that. So yeah, I think that was the initial, you know, sort of start of digitalization. If you think back to that era, you know, probably less than 50%, maybe 40% of households in the United States actually had computers in the household.
Yeah.
So how things have changed.
No, it's incredible. And, you know, at that time, the really big the transformation was, as it is right now with streaming, it was about distribution, right? The ability to, first of all, stream content maybe through a digital, through a satellite, right? And then get that content through a cable to a household, right? I remember, you know, I worked for Turner Warner Media now for many, many years. In the 90s, I remember tales inside of the business of when CNN launched in the 90s, right? Or late 80s. And then in 92 with the Persian War, it was the only network that could actually, that was reporting from the war. And that's when it really boomed in the US market, because people suddenly could have access to what was going on real time, thanks to technology, right? And that's really where, you know, where it all started for CNN's growth. And like that, there's many, many examples of other networks that use technology at that time, embrace change, embrace digital change to grow, right?
Absolutely.
But somehow at some point, those business, and this, I think we see this in every line of business, but somehow at some point, businesses become so established that embracing change is not that welcome, right? There's new competitors. Let's talk about.
But that said, I mean, look, this business, and we talk about this business, right? The entertainment or general entertainment business, as it relates to, you know, television or telecommunications, you know, call it that, because there's like a whole, you know, merge going on there. I mean, not to get into today, but if you look back to your point about transformation, you know, if you look back over the years, I mean, yeah, I mean, cable went from being something that was bringing a TV signals, broadcast TV signals into rural areas where the signals weren't reaching. And it started off as that, right? A master antenna system to deliver that, to eventually evolve to being like, we're going to bring you, you know, a bunch of different channels that are unique to cable, and all, and these networks started developing, right? CNN, like you mentioned, TNT, Discovery, TLC, ESPN, of course, HBO,
MTV.
I mean, all these networks started, niche networks curated in a very special fashion, started developing and growing. And it just became, the transformation was over and over. I mean, it was like keeping up with also the technology, the developments of technology. You know, there was a point in time where you could only squeeze through 36 channels to get into the household, into the little converter box in the household. Eventually that went up to, okay, we can now do 70 channels through compression. So the transformation, and then eventually, of course, 100, 200, 500. It's just, what technology allows, with technology evolving and the rapid pace of its evolution and accelerating pace of its evolution, has all enabled this incredible transformation from those early days that I just talked about to obviously getting to the point of where we are today.
Of course. So what would you say are the effects of COVID in the acceleration of the latest trend of digital transformation? I was reading the Global Entertainment and Media Outlook that PwC puts out every now and then. And they were saying that the media and entertainment industry will post a 2.8 compound annual growth rate through 2024. But they were saying that some segments will expand quickly, some will contract, right? It's not going to be across the board. But what we do know is that COVID-19 has accelerated some trends. So what would you say are the effects of COVID-19 into this industry?
Well, I mean, look, I think overall viewership of video has increased dramatically. And whether that is, traditional linear television channels, I mean, you saw audience levels increase pretty dramatically to, of course, then the whole phenomenon of, binge watching shows on a streaming service. I think, COVID came to a point where maybe it encouraged organizations who were in the process of developing their own platforms to accelerate that and get those platforms to market. It take time. I mean, it's complicated to build a consumer facing platform that can be successful. And if you launch with, unable to really provide the technology for the consumer to be satisfied, then it's get the kiss of death, right? I mean, people are going to not be able to use it, right? So, I mean, to your question specifically, I think overall it increased the viewership, video viewership in all its fashions, broad scope speaking. I think it also accelerated the demand of streaming platforms. Well, it's accelerated the development of streaming platforms and therefore the demand. More people are, experimenting and trying to figure out what is the best platform to suit my needs or how many platforms do I really want to subscribe to.
That's interesting. I was reading that there's apparently over 300 different platforms for people to choose from. I mean, from very niche to the known suspects, right? Like Netflix and Prime and HBO Max, to the obscure ones that are very niche oriented. There's over 300 platforms people can choose.
Well, and you got two components to that, right? You've got the subscription based platforms like the Netflixes and the Discovery Plus and the Disney Plus, and some that have a component that is advertising supported, right? AVOD, advertising video on demand supported. Some have the two pieces. Okay, you can come in through my AVOD at no cost. You're going to be receiving commercials. And then if you want the premium version, you upgrade. So you've got, them living. Some live specifically on streaming. I liken those to the old days of the premium channels, right? Yeah. They still exist today. Not so old days. But the premium channels that we have on cable and satellite television, in our industry as it's known as the providers being the MVPDs, right? The cable and satellite providers. And I think that subscription-based model is the premium model, right? And then you've got the basic cable model, as it is in our industry, that is equal to the AVOD model. And you can access AVOD. Yeah, you can access the AVOD, and that's why there's so many platforms, right? And it's all relying on the run of advertising support.
Yeah, and just for the benefits of our listeners, AVOD meaning advertising VOD, right? Advertising video.
Exactly. It's supported by advertising. It's it's generally free to the consumer after, of course, they've paid the entry price of having the internet or broadband into the home, or wireless capabilities to be able to download it or view it streaming on your tablet or your phone, whatever it is. But you know, Gerardo, I think, you know, there's, you know, it's interesting to watch this. This game is not over. You know, it continues. There's something that is very concerning within the context of these streaming platforms. Whether it be a subscription video on demand platform, whether it be AVOD platform, I think on the AVOD side is, you know, to what degree can you support and rationalize the investment and the level of content that's going to continue to attract consumers to that AVOD platform? Does it have that curated content in a way that is so appealing that it's just going to keep people coming back? Yeah. That's a challenge for them. And on the subscription side, the challenge is what we call churn, right? Churn is turnover, it's people disconnecting. It's a term that, and I remember back from my cable operators day, was a critical term. We were always watching, it's the churn level, because you have to sell 1,000 in order to overcome a churn level where people are disconnecting at the rate of 900. And you know, your net gain, you only gain 100 customers. So I think that's the big challenge here.
And the cost of customer acquisition too, right? I mean, how do you acquire customers, and to what cost that would basically make your business profitable, right?
You know, if you think back again, you go back to that dot-com era, the dot-com bubble. I remember reading an article at one point, and I don't know the exact number, but it was something like 12 out of the 32 different commercials that aired on the Super Bowl that given year, maybe it was 98 or 99, I suppose, were actually dot-com company commercials, right? Yeah. So you look now at commercials on television, and you see them all the time, right? You see the ads for streaming services all the time.
Well, it's true, but I think, you know, what it's interesting is that while in the old model, you needed the economics to survive, right? I mean, you needed the revenue from distribution and advertising to be able to survive. And in many cases, if you couldn't find that distribution or if you couldn't find sponsors, you would not be able to have your business, right? Now, the fact that some of these businesses are going direct to consumer is opening up the opportunity to be able to have a sustainable business that it could be limited in size, right? Because you might be targeting a niche. You know how, you know, there's right now, you know, there's very successful businesses targeting niches like Japanese manga, for example, or horror, like Shudder in the US, horror, or like Acorn, which is targeting expats, English expats in the US, right? I mean, and you could have a viable business without needing to have the masses of audiences that some of these bigger streaming services have, right? I mean, I think that has opened up all sorts of opportunities for hyper niche that you couldn't have before, or if you had it, it would be hard to survive.
Look, yes, it opens up the opportunity. I think whether or not they're successful and viable businesses is yet to be seen. I mean, let's look at a horizon, right? I mean, we can't evaluate that on the basis of a, you know, 2-3 year horizon. I think we've got to look at least a decade here and say, do they?
Okay. Decade. I agree.
I don't know. It's because I think at the end of the day, it's how do they control the cost? How do they satisfy that unique niche that you're talking about and provide them with the level of content that they're going to be willing to pay the whatever it is, $3, $4, $6 a month for that very unique application. And it's happening. I mean, it's been happening, in a way for a while within the sports world, right? I mean, there's levels of sports packages that you could get. You know, I mean, DirecTV had a very successful offer in partnership with the NFL for a significant volume and amount of NFL content, of football games primarily, but you know, other type of content as well. So yeah, it'll be I think it does open up that window. It'll be interesting to see how many can make that business successful.
So when thinking about change, right, and going through change, going through something new, in your experience as you've managed thousands of people, right? You've managed big organizations and small organizations. What are the key organizational challenges, right? I mean, what do you have to think through when you think about the organization you need to confront these challenges? I mean, are there any insights you could share there?
Well, I think, you know, skill set, the skill set changes as organizations evolve at any time. So I think keeping up with and having a mindset of looking for people that bring a particular skill set that may be missing within the existing organization, I think is crucial. Training, I mean, I think also to provide training and development opportunities for people within the organization to learn about, you know, where things are going, how things are evolving, and to develop their own skill sets in that area. I think, structurally, there's also issues in terms of, you know, the organizational's, you know, structures, and sometimes have their silos and
the processes, right? Yeah.
This is my area of domain, if you will. And when you're trying to do something new, like streaming, for example, in your industry, you need to reorganize, you need to restructure in a way that's going to make it nimble, in a way that's going to give the right people access to the CEO level, CFO level, to be able to, you know, lobby on behalf of the investment necessary for that business to evolve, to emerge and evolve, and not get lost within the, you know, bureaucracy, if you will, that may exist in a legacy environment.
It's interesting, right? Because a lot of these challenges, when you're a big organization, you have to deal with that on top of the consumer trends and behaviors and industry trends. Well, if some of the native businesses are already born that way, right? And that becomes an advantage in a way that they have. So it's interesting. And by the way, this is not unique to the media and entertainment industry. It's real to any industry, right? Incumbents are always at a disadvantage when it comes to being able to move that huge organization into this new mindset, right?
Absolutely. And you know, sometimes, you know, when you're the incumbent and you're sitting with a very successful business in a very focused fashion, and you've got the challengers that are coming up, I mean, for a window of time, you kind of like maybe not even pay too much attention to them. You go, is that really going to happen? I mean, you go back to the Netflix thing. I mean, they, again, you know, remember, they kind of eventually put Blockbuster out of business. And they started a very simple model, right? Back in, what year was that?
In the 90s. Around 97, 95?
I think it was 97. And then they found their way and they evolved. And all of a sudden it was like, whoa, Netflix is here. You know, and if you think about the way that the business model worked traditionally in our space, you had, you know, companies that were in a way, you know, kind of like direct to consumer, like the HBOs and Showtimes and Cinemaxes of the world. They were speaking to the consumer. It was an option, right? It was an add-on. And so they had to invest a lot of money in speaking to the consumer and developing the content. And they did not have the advertising support component. So, yes. You think about it from, you know, those years back, And then they obviously their business model was one that was hand in hand with the provider, the cable or satellite provider. And therefore it was like a wholesale model, right? The producers would be here, they would create programs, they would then curate them and put them into a channel and brand that channel. And then they would sell it to the cable operator, who would in turn then rep it to the consumer. And it was, you know, both the cable operator as well as the programmer were responsible for marketing and trying to get the consumer to come in and then reduce churn, because churn rates could run as high as, mm-hmm. on premium television, churn rates can run as high as 30-40%. So it's pretty high. So you have to, you know, go back into that investment model that you mentioned before about investing on bringing in new clients. But as that's happening, along comes this disruptor that says, wait a minute, I don't need to go through the traditional channels. I don't need to go to a cable operator as Netflix and say, hey, cable operator, I want you to carry my Netflix channel, distribute it and sell it to customers. And then we'll share in the revenue, you know, we'll sell it for $10 and you get five and I get five. Well, that model is now being broken apart. And Netflix is saying, you know what? I think technology is going to enable us little by little more. Is going to enable us to actually, instead of just shipping these DVDs to people's houses, or never mind having the brick and mortar stores that, you know, Blockbuster had, I'm going to go and I'm going to be able to deliver this via these, you know, wires and internet and eventually fiber optic, right? That's launching. They had the vision of where this pipeline was going to enable the transmission of, you know, quality video. And then, you know, years ago, like we were thinking, video on through the internet is really bad, right?
Yeah.
Look at this.
So what would you say then is the next wave in terms of the future of streaming? I mean, they saw that happening, right? But what is it that we can see will happen in the next 4 to 5 years that would change this? I mean, do you see any trends emerging in the future of streaming?
I think it's a great question. Look, I
have my own point of view, but I want to hear you first.
Yeah, I mean, look, I agree with your point about, you know, really, really hyper niche services. Like one is, you know, for example, you know, Formula One. Formula One is not a broad sport. Everybody watches Formula One. But for a Formula One enthusiast to subscribe to the Formula One, you know, streaming platform is a no-brainer. So I think those types of niche services that you mentioned, you know, do continue to evolve. I mean, you threw out a number of, there's 300 different, you know, platform options. I don't know what the number is, but if it's somewhere like that, there could be more. There could be more coming. I think that, you know, the consumer begins to rationalize. What's the value of what I'm getting in my traditional package? You know, there's all this hype about people disconnecting the traditional cable. Of course, there's been some of that, but not to the extent of what, you know, you can perceive the hype telling you. I mean, people are maintaining, and I think people will understand or begin to rationalize the value, because if they drop their traditional video package and say, I'm just going to buy internet. Okay, you don't have the benefits of a price bundle. You're going to pay more for that internet, and then you're going to subscribe, and then you're eventually going to realize, what am I missing here? So I think it'll be...
Okay, but I have a question there, right? Because I don't know if I agree or disagree with you yet. Because I think there's like a hybrid. I think the cable subscription model has a hybrid, right? With offerings like YouTube Live or like Hulu, right? Where you're getting the live channels, right? You're getting, you know, that a variety of content, you know, whatever it is, 120 channels, but you also have the on-demand content, right? So you have the option as a user, as a viewer, to choose how you want to consume that content.
Right? But the same can be said for the traditional package that you buy from a Comcast or a Bright House.
True.
Spectrum. You know, the same can be said in terms of they've got the traditional package and they've got a wide variety of AVOD that they provide as well. And then in some cases, they also have their streaming offering alongside of it, like Peacock.
So it's a hybrid. So basically what we're saying is the industry is moving to that hybrid.
Well, you know, and it's interesting.
Where streaming is part of it.
Yeah, it's interesting because it kind of like moved in both directions, right? I mean, look, YouTube was something completely different, right? I mean, it was on-demand, you know, video clips, and then eventually YouTube got into YouTube TV. And, it was very attractive price point, by the way.
Yeah.
Until they realized that to have quality content from a variety of providers in order to be able to provide a package that could compete with other providers, traditional cable providers and others like Sling, which by the way has been doing this for a long time, they needed to pay up for that content.
Yeah.
And lo and behold, their price point for YouTube TV had to triple. And you know, it's now, what is it, $70, $75? So it's very comparable, becomes very comparable at that point to maintaining that subscription that you have in the household, the traditional basic cable subscription that you have. There's no price differential. And
they're starting to meet in the middle, as you said, right? Even with Prime buying an NFL live package, right? With the, you know, there's some shows you can only watch on Prime or Peacock. Peacock, I think, is actually a great example too. I mean, you can watch some games on NBC Sports through your cable operator, and some games you have to watch them on Peacock, right? And it has to be Peacock Premium. So, I mean, all of these, you know, in a way, all of these content license owners have smartened up in terms of, I mean, they're using the windowing strategy, right? And they're putting content in different windows to try to extract as much sense as possible from the investment they've done in IP, in intellectual property or content.
Right. So, you know, back to your question, I think even greater fragmentation continues to happen. I think you see some of those companies that were subscription video in demand and they begin to tap out their ability to grow because, you know, it's not like they can grow in more and more international markets that either don't exist or just not going to be the right markets for their product. So I think you may see some of those also begin to experiment on the advertising side because ultimately to continue to grow your business, right? I mean, you either need more subscribers, mm-hmm. wherever they may be, or you need to increase price points to the extent that you can, or let's find a new business model that can help us to grow our bottom line so our stock value continues to appreciate, right? That's advertising. That's advertising. And then in the AVOD world is how do you get to a point of having greater appreciation of what the value of that advertising is. You know, how do you deliver the right target audiences? How do you protect yourself from delivering the wrong type of ads at the wrong moment in time? Mm-hmm. You know, there's a safety component, if you will, that is a something that, you know, cable and broadcast media, television obviously provides, and as a result, gains significantly higher CPMs. I think that's to me, you know, those are some of the issues that we're faced with here, and that we will see as the streaming future evolves here.
That's very very interesting. Something that I've thought also about the future of streaming is that right now, there is this growth, I mean, it's been for a while, this growth in the creators vertical, right? People, creators going straight to consumers, not even going through, you know, they're even bypassing the streaming the streaming services, mm-hmm. right? And you see that in YouTube with creators, you see, in particular, creators are doing it in social channels like TikTok. There's platforms like Proteus, right? That that are specific for creators, right? You know, people that have expertise in one topic. Maybe they're comedians. Maybe they play guitar really well. Maybe they know about finance. And you know, you have all of these types of different creators that are now creating content going straight and getting transactions out of that, right? And the same is happening with the YouTube channels, right? Where you have YouTube channels that have grown because they have become almost studios themselves, right? And then lately they've been acquired, you know, I know that Viacom acquired Porta dos Fondos in Brazil and others across the world, but that's another phenomenon that I think is not gonna stop, actually is going to increase, you know, the growth of the creator model.
Well, it's part of that fragmentation. It really is a piece of it. The challenge is there's so much of it, Gerardo, is how do they stand out? And how do they draw a sufficient audience? Is it a passion play for somebody who just loves doing it and it's not necessarily a moneymaker? Well, they can keep doing it. If it's a business, then the question is how does that become a business? That's the challenge. Is how does that really become a business?
Yeah, still, I mean, you could see. I was reading about there's this YouTube channel in Sweden that amassed 9 billion views on their channel, 9 million views, and those are content creators. I mean, they're a mature content creators. It's a comedy channel. It's called PewDiePie, it's based on the relationship they have with their viewers, right? Because the advantage they have over a normal comedy channel is the fact that now they're reading, they have that direct relationship with the consumer. They respond to that, right? It's starting a new type of content relationship as well. Mm-hmm. I just find that fascinating, and I'm interested to see how that is going to evolve into weave itself into.
Yeah, the fabric of this business.
Into the fabric of this business. Yes, yes, yes. So let's talk a little bit about, I would like to talk about IP. I think that's a good segue into this. I mean, how important in this new world is, how important it is to own your original IP, intellectual property, your own content, produce original shows, original material?
I think it goes back to what's your business model, you know, because original IP is very, very expensive to develop, right? So it depends. The easy answer is it's critical. It's always been very important, but the model was a model that enabled that original IP producer, the person, the company who invested in the original content, to window it, have a windowing strategy. Mm-hmm. Right, to release it as original on their network or on their service for a period of time, and then ultimately to window it into other platforms. So I think that one of the things I've seen is more and more of, we're not windowing. It's, you know, this is our content, this is our library, and if you want it, here's where you got to come and get it. So I see, you know, an increase in the, yes, in the investment and in the need to have original IP as your differentiator, and then you retain it. So that changes that business model. You're not getting the licensing revenue coming from, you know, second or third windows that you used to get. That said, there can be very successful organizations that stay in the business of developing content for licensing purposes. And, you know, you can... If you look at it from the perspective of AVOD platforms, for example, some of the more successful AVOD platforms are doing it on the backs of licensing content.
True.
And they can't, honestly, they can't afford to do much in the original content development space. You know, they have a very limited ability. So their best way, in my opinion, best way to go at it for some of these AVOD or most of the AVOD platforms is, you know, develop that niche, curate the content appropriately, identify where to license that content. And then that's, you know, that becomes the the gold mine, the attraction for that particular platform.
Yeah.
So I think it's a balance. I mean, yes, you know, on the one hand, for certain platforms, and particularly those that are in subscription video on demand models, those platforms, that original content, that unique identifier, that this is the only place you can get it, because you're not buying those platforms only for the purpose of what they're going to give me tonight and tomorrow, but you're buying it also for the purpose and the value that this rich library has. And if I'm a lover of cooking shows, or if I'm a lover of, you know, drama, or car show, whatever it is, I know I can go into this platform or that platform or that platform and watch the content that, you know, I'm really attracted to. And, you know, it doesn't matter if it was created 2 years ago or 3 years ago. If I haven't seen it, it's prime time to me.
Of course. No, I get that. I get that. Still, I, you know, when I see what's going on as a consumer, right? When I, as a consumer, it never happened to me that I would go into one of these streaming platforms and not find anything to watch, right? And I think you would always find something to watch.
Yeah.
But then after a year and a half of being stuck at home, suddenly we've gone through all of these platforms, and I hear my kids. I have two teenagers at home, and they get bored with it. It's like there's nothing to watch in Netflix, or there's nothing to watch in Prime. I mean, they've gone through everything, right? So these networks or these groups are starting to churn out shows. Obviously, there was also a lull on show production because of COVID too, right? But now they're starting to churn out shows, and people are binge watching them, right? And what I tend to see is that now, that is what people go into these platforms to watch. Before you would go there to watch, let's say they had The Office or they had a Two Men and a Half, and you would binge watch that. But there is now a new, I feel there's a new demand for new content. And when you see what's happening in the award shows, when you see what's happening with who's winning what, like the Emmys just passed, and, you know, I don't know, Netflix and Apple, you know, they dominated, right?
Mm-hmm.
Prime has won a couple of best movie awards in the Oscars, right? So I guess what I'm trying to say is content creators, good quality content creators, are now starting to, not starting, I mean, have officially landed in streaming and are enjoying it, right? You know, they have so much freedom to produce, and there's the ability to catch audiences directly, and that's a phenomenon. I'll be interested to see your take on that. But I mean, I see such great content in this platform that at the beginning they were curators, and now they are original content platform, known for that.
Right. I agree. And I think, look, it's a matter of developing the talent. I mean, over the years, you know, a streaming platform that, you know, is focused on direct, you know, to consumer applications, is developing the talent and or identifying the right, you know, producers and showrunners, you know, the people they need to form a team to be able to create the level of content that, you know, in the past you would think back to an HBO as being the only one being able to produce, you know, movies for pay TV in that fashion.
It's not TV, it's HBO.
Yeah,
that was the tagline, right?
But so yeah, I mean, it's a matter of, again, in their own way, they've developed the skill sets, if you will, to be able to produce at a quality level.
And that's what I think. That's what justifying audiences pay for that subscription, right? Because I want to watch this show or that show on this platform, right? And it's part of the strategy for, I think it's part of the strategy for content acquisition in terms of, and that, listen, that's not different to how it was with TV networks, right? I mean, Fox would produce The Simpsons, and people would would tune into Fox to watch The Simpsons, and they would use The Simpsons ad breaks to cross promote other shows. I mean, the model is, technology has enabled different ways of cross promotion, but you know, I think the importance of IP to draw an audience to your channel or to your service, it still remains the same, right?
Yes, it does. You know, the question though is, you know, are you in a business model that can sustain the level of investment necessary for that, right? Okay. And that's why I think that there can be some really well-curated AVOD platforms that can also do it with principally, if not 100%, licensed
content. I agree with you, and I agree with you, especially when with the phrase well-curated, right? I think that's where... this is a good segue to another segment we wanted to discuss, which is personalized content, right? The importance of curation and personalized content to be able to satisfy these new customer trends and demands, right? Let's talk about that a little bit more. I mean, right now with technology, platforms, AVOD platforms, all type of platforms, they have the algorithms, artificial intelligence to figure out what you're watching. Mm-hmm. And
helps make recommendations.
What else you like, right?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I think it's exposing you to content that you're more likely to see or to want to see, mm-hmm. As a result of their ability to, you know, capitalize on technology to be able to use the AI to do that. So I think it's a very, very targeted marketing tool, if you will, that, you know, never existed before. And within their own, you know, space, within their own environment, they're now making recommendations to you. Hey, welcome back. Last time you watched this, do you want to continue watching that series? Or would you like to, you know, we think you would enjoy this or this or this. Oh, yeah. Look at that.
Yeah.
So I think it's, you know, it's a great use of AI in terms of its, you know, the targeting capability to reinforce the content that they have.
It's about, I took some notes here. It's about making relevant content discoverable, right? Because right now there's so much content. One of the issues we have is that there's so much content. Where do we start, right? And there's an effect. There's signs that shows that when we have too much to choose from, we choose less because we get overwhelmed by choice, right? So it's a very good use of technology to help us making relevant content discoverable. Also, increasing the average user content consumption, right? If I could get that user to spend a little bit more time in my platform watching my content, you know, that's valuable to me, right? Especially if I'm in an AVOD environment. And then for freemium services like Peacock or like Hulu or like others, it allows me to have and to convert maybe a free customer to a premium customer through personalization.
Right. Yep. Look, you know, it's also a matter of how much content can be absorbed, right? I mean, if you think about it, aside from, you know, we talk about the evolution here of video and the different applications. I mean, we barely skim the surface on other platforms that are social media platforms, for example, and the amount of content that they provide. I mean, there is the element of the social element of it, but then there's also a variety of content that is available through many of those platforms. So, you know, you wind up with, it is overwhelming. You're right. You know, it does get to a point of, well, what am I going to watch now? And it can be very addictive. You know, and you see it, where people just get locked down into that phone and it's like, okay, look out, there's a car coming. You know, it's so, I don't know, it's a balance.
And we haven't even touched on the topic of brands as content producers, right? Now brands are becoming studios themselves and developing original content for their audiences, right? Brands of all types, like Red Bull, developing extreme sports content to even Headspace, the meditation app.
Yep.
You know, they, you know, they're creating their own well-being content, right? That it's streamed through the app. I have my spouse, she uses it, and she watches a lot of, I mean, it's competing for her screen time with traditional streaming platforms, because the content that is delivered through this meditation app is very relevant to what her interest is.
Yeah.
Right?
I mean, that's, yeah, and that's what we were talking about, you know, greater fragmentation, very targeted content where smaller groups of people who are interested in whatever it is can go to, and it's consistent.
Yep.
This is what I'm interested in. This is what I want to watch. This is what I want to learn about. So, yeah.
So I guess in conclusion, the media entertainment industry, it hasn't only embraced change for 30, 40 years already. I mean, change and digital transformation is going to continue for the foreseeable future. It's kind of like embedded in the DNA of this industry. And
it's evolutionary, right? I mean, it's any industry has its cycles, and those organizations that figure out how to, you know, ride the next wave of opportunity are the ones that survive, and you know, others are unable to. So I think it's not just in our industry, but in industry throughout history, evolution is, you know, is a reality. It has to be. Otherwise, we're stuck.
I know. Henry, we're getting close to finishing. I always like to, before we finish, go through a section that is basically a rapid fire. I'm going to rapid fire a few questions and want to hear your answer. And it's a little bit off topic. It's just
do I get points and win money for it?
No, you don't. You get my appreciation. So first of all, what is your favorite TV show right now?
Okay. How about Friends?
Really?
Love it.
I mean, are you binge watching it again?
Shut the night down without catching a Friends episode, man.
That feel good factor, right?
Oh yeah, it's always fun.
Awesome. Okay. Second question: movie theaters, will they find a way of reinventing, or will they go bust?
They're relying on me. They're going to go bust.
You're not going back to the movie theater anymore.
I have not gone in years.
In years. Yeah. Okay. Okay.
Only to take my granddaughters, by the way, a few, you know.
Well, I mean, this is the thing. I think we have a movie theater close by, the ones that, you know, they serve you food and they do drinks on top of that. But now what they're doing is live events. So instead of going there to watch a movie, you're going there to watch a Coldplay concert live, that it's streamed live from location to a network of movie theaters. I think that's part of, again, transformation and embracing change and trying to lure people back to.
Yeah, look, they've got to figure out what to do with that real estate.
Yeah.
So, I mean, they either figure out what to do with it, or it gets, gets destroyed and somebody builds something else that's going to work better in that space.
So. Yeah. Last questions. Will we ever go back to the office, or will the trend towards remote work continue growing?
Oh, I think it's a balance. I think there's a lot more flexibility now. I think there's greater recognition by senior management that the work can get done. I think that there is a huge issue around culture. You know, can you develop, can you establish the kind of culture? I mean, there's also, you know, the aspect of the personal relationships. So hopefully we'll find a good balance between the two. You know, there's certain roles, of course, that it's ideal for them to be able to be in the office, or necessary for them to be in the office. There's others where, you know, it might not really matter. So look, I think it becomes very personal thing, both between the employee in terms of, you know, what is preferable to them in their life, and obviously the employer in terms of, can that role be done, and are we willing to accept that people are more and more, you know, full-time working from home and not coming to the office. So I think there's going to be a balance, Gerardo. I think it's, you know, I hear a lot of people who are like, oh, I'll never change it again. I just don't want to go back to the office. I don't want to deal with traffic. It's, you know, all those things, which make sense. And then there's also a lot of other people that say really, really miss being in the office environment. I mean, there is the social element that we're just going to socialize like this. You know, it gets lost.
And I think especially for younger people is, you know, that's even more important, right? Because that's where you meet people. That's where you meet friends. That's where you maybe meet partners, right? I mean, when you're younger, being able to, it really defines who you are more than when you're slightly older. Maybe you have a family. Maybe you have more reasons to stay at home, right? I mean, I think it will depend by generation or by age too. Anyway, Henry, this has been a very, very good conversation. I really appreciate your insights, and I really appreciate your time with us. I'm sure people are going to enjoy this conversation.
Yeah, my pleasure. It's great to be here with you. I just want to tell you, you know, next time you and your family find that you've like run out of all this content to watch on all these streaming platforms, you know, let's not forget the rest of the world out there. You come on down, bring the kids down, we'll go do some fishing, okay?
I would love that. In fact, I will take you on that. I'm going on a fishing trip this weekend with my son. So I'm awesome. I'm not that far away from that.
Yeah. There's a lot to do in those other experiences in the world than just viewing the screen. So
I know.
Right balance, right?
I know. Excellent. Thank you very much. And the as always, it's been a pleasure.
Take care, Gerardo. Great to see you.